Welcome to our final presentation for Chapter 5, Introduction to Stocks. And in this presentation, we will discuss the various types of stocks, market capitalization, and we'll end with some strategies, different stock investing strategies. So let's take a look at slide number 75. We are going to enumerate some of the major types of stocks. These aren't the only types. And what you're going to find is that some companies are easily fit into some of these categories, and some companies aren't. And sometimes companies are parts of different categories. They fit into one or more categories. The first category on slide 75 is blue chip stocks. Blue chip stocks are the biggest companies. They are the most strongest. They have the strongest companies. They have the roots deep in the economy. Financially strong, high quality stocks with long and stable records of earnings and dividends. Sometimes people refer to them as value stocks, although be careful, we're going to discuss the term value in detail in a bit. They attract conservative investors. Now, this has nothing to do with politics, folks. These are just people who want to invest in stocks but are afraid of losing money. But that doesn't mean you won't lose money. For example, General Electric and General Motors, right? For decades, these two companies were considered the bluest of the blue, and yet the old GM went bankrupt, and GE, in the financial turmoil, really took it on the chin, because you thought GE was an industrial company that makes lighting equipment and power plants and the like, and they are, but at the time of the financial turmoil in 2008, they were making more money off of finance than they were off of industrials, right? Who are other examples of blue chip stocks? Coca-Cola, right? They sell that fizzy sugar water to people all around the world, and people drink it for some odd reason. Those are the big, you know the names. Exxon in energy and Chevron. In the health field, Johnson & Johnson. Procter & Gamble in the consumer products, Kraft in the food company, in the food industry, and Kellogg's. The next category are income stocks. And these are sometimes related to the blue chip stocks, sometimes not. They are stocks with long and sustained records of paying higher than average dividends. Again, you will often hear people refer to them as value stocks. They are normally slow growth companies in mature industries. For example, utilities. Utilities are not growing really fast, right, unless the area that they're in is exploding. But are they going to go anywhere? Are people all of a sudden going to decide to start taking cold showers in the dark? No. SDG&E, San Diego Gas and Electric, which is owned by a parent company called Sempra, will be around in 25 years. But are they going to explode on the upside? No. The other archetypal example of income stocks for decades were banks. Until the banks started playing wonderful little games and getting themselves into serious trouble, and some of them didn't survive. Well, they're coming back, folks. The banks are coming back because remember, when you grow up, you want to be a bank. Mm-hmm. Slide number 76. Now, growth stocks. The stars. All the companies with the beautiful hair and the brilliant white teeth and the six-pack abs. These are the companies that are featured on the cover of GQ and Vanity Unfair. Right. Stocks that experience high rates of growth in operations and earnings. Growth rates of 15 to 20% or higher. Now, that may not sound that big, but folks, if you were growing at 20% in 3 years, you'd be twice your size. Often associated with high P.E. ratios. Now, wait a minute. What's this? Remember P.E.? Price divided by earnings, right? That means that the investors are excited about their prospects because they're growing. Often no dividends at all or a very small token amount. Why? Because most of the profits are being reinvested into the company. So they need the profits to grow the company. And the stock price should go up. But usually it's going to be very volatile, which means you better be ready for a bumpy ride. Now let's take a look at some examples. Intel, Microsoft, wait a minute. Are Intel, Microsoft, and Hewlett-Packard, are they still growth stocks? Well, I don't know about HP. I know, I think Intel and Microsoft are still growing, but not like they were 20 years ago. No, these have become mature companies. Who are the growth stocks now? Right, the social media stocks, Facebook and Twitter, and all the other LinkedIn, and who else? I mean, now there's a company called Snapchat or something like that. No, Snapchat. And these companies are growing at tremendous rates, or at least they just were. The world moves very quickly nowadays, and they're on the cover of Vogue and GQ, and everybody talks about them. And you can make a lot of money, and you can lose a lot of money, too, because there's many investors who not just look at the rate of growth. For you math fans, that's the first derivative. No, they look at the rate of the growth of the growth, and that's the second derivative. And if it just dares to slow down, they dump the stock, and the price plummets. Yeah, it's a bumpy ride. Slide number 77. We are going to discuss these two terms in detail over the next few weeks, growth and value. The investment world loves to use the terms growth and value, but you have to be careful because the meanings of the terms are not exact depending on who you are talking to. Typically, what you'll find is investors often use the term growth to designate a high P/E stock, while they use the term value to denote a low P/E stock. But in my mind, that's not what value means, folks. Value to me means there's something there that I'm interested in. You understand? So if there's value there, then a high P/E stock might be a great value. But if there's no value there, a low P/E stock might not be a good value. You see how we're... Exactly. We're using value to describe value. For example, let's take an example. In January of 2005, Google had just gone public a few months earlier and had gone from around $85 to $200. But it had a sky-high P.E. I think it was 66 or something like that. While the old GM was selling for $34 and a very low P.E. and was paying, I forget, it was an outrageous amount in dividends. Well, today Google sells for actually much more than $7.55. I have to change that. With a much lower P.E., and the old GM stock, also known as Motors Liquidation, last sold for 4 cents in March of 2011, and now it's worthless. So tell me which one was the better stock, which one was the better value. You understand? So be careful. You're going to hear people talk about growth and value, and they're going to be use them as substitutes for high PE and low PE. But just because a stock has a high PE doesn't mean it's not a good value, and just because a stock has a low PE doesn't mean it's a good value. All right, slide number 78. Let's make sure I press the right button. Cyclical stocks. What are cyclical stocks? These are round companies? No. These are companies who follow closely the general state of the economy. The economy does well, they'll do well. The economy doesn't do well, they'll do poorly. And the poster child, the archetypal example, so to speak, for cyclical stocks are automobiles. Yes, car companies. When the economy's doing well, people are getting raises, new jobs. What do? They run out and buy a new car. I don't know how they got them. I guess it's part of our car culture. And when the economy does poorly, what do people do? Right. My old Betsy's doing just fine, thank you very much. And that's how it works. So when the economy does well, you'll see car companies make a ton of money. And then when the economy does poorly, they will just, it's like falling off a cliff for them. But any company that makes stuff, folks, in this case, our examples are timber and steel, but chemicals. And now, chips, computers and the like, because when the economy expands, there's more need for electronics. On the other side of this multifaceted coin are defensive stocks. They are stocks that tend to hold their own and even often do well when the economy starts to falter. Why? Because these are defensive, not defense. I'm not talking about companies that make defense products. I'm talking about companies that will remain stable during declines in the market, for the most part. And why is that? Because these are companies that whose products are needed no matter what happens. No, if the economy does well, do you eat more Cheerios or more cornflakes? Do you use less soap? If the economy does poorly? No. So Kellogg's and Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble makes Tide and Head & Shoulders. Exactly. Ivory Snow. So when the economy's raging, the defensive stocks are sort of sitting on the sidelines and not really doing anything exciting. But then when the economy backs off and we have a recession, these defensive stocks, they might actually go up. Why? Because of rotation, it's called. Investors especially buy and sell, traders, speculators, will move out of the growth stocks, out of the cyclical stocks, and into defensive stocks. They might go down too, folks, but they're not going to go down as much. Or they might even go up, but when the economy's doing really well, they'll probably just lag far behind their cyclical and growth cousins. Now, turnaround stocks. I like to call them goners because most of the time they are. But these are companies that have fallen on hard times. And what you as a investor, as an investor, have to dig deeply and discover is there a potential for a rebound? Many of you weren't around at this time, but in the early 80s, Chrysler almost disappeared. And it's a wonderful case study for you business fans. A gentleman by the name of Lee Iacocca, who had worked at Ford. In fact, he was responsible for he was the lead project manager for the Mustang in the 1960s, which is still around, so it's a very popular car. And he took over Chrysler and brought it back from the brink. He had help, don't get me wrong, but if you had invested in Chrysler when it had hit the skids, you would have done very, very well for yourself. And this is true now of Chrysler, but Chrysler's not quite public again. It will be, maybe, we don't know. Fiat's trying to take it over. But Ford and GM, they are turnaround cases, and so far, so good. Asset play stocks. These are companies that are sitting on an asset that could be sold or spun off in case there's trouble, or just because, you know, there's value there and they could spin it off and make a ton of money just by making it on it, giving it its liberty, giving it its freedom. And here it's, you have to really dig a little deeper. You have to look behind the public face of the company. An example is JCPenney's. Everyone knows them for their retail business, but in the late 90s, early 2000s, all the department stores were having a rough go of it. They were being hit from below by the Walmarts and the Costcos and the Targets, and they were being hit from above by the Nordstrom's and Needless Markup and the like. And many of them are gone. You remember Mervon, right? And you remember Montgomery Ward's, the Broadway, Robinson's May Company, yeah. But JCPenney's has survived. Some people are saying just barely. But even today, if they get into trouble, they have an insurance division that's very profitable. You don't think of insurance when you think of JCPenney's, but that company, I forget its name, Touchstone or something like that, they will sell you life insurance for your newborn baby. Everybody has a newborn baby. They send them out a little brochure. Wouldn't you like insurance for your baby? Stupid. But hey, it's very, very profitable for them. So if they do get into serious trouble, they've got that asset that they're sitting on. What are some other examples? You look at the company Pepsi and you think, wow, you know, there's a beverage company. But dig a little deeper and very quickly you'll realize that they make a lot of money selling snacks. Why? Because they own Frito-Lay. Uh-huh. And they spun off, as I said, Yum Brands. Who are they? I know you're just dying to know, but you won't look it up. So you go look up who Yum Brands is. And you'll instantly know who they are. How about other assets? Railroads, right. The railroads are very profitable when economies are doing well because stuff needs to be moving around. But also they are sitting on tons of land that was given to them 160, 180 years ago. And they own big chunks of downtown cities all around the country. Exactly. Now, this last category here is penny stocks. And these are scams, folks. We discussed the OTC markets and the pink sheets, it used to be called, and the bulletin board, the OTC bulletin board. Most of these companies are not real companies. Some of them are companies that are down on their luck or maybe never really became a bona fide company. But most all of them are not real companies. There's somebody's garage in Idaho or Iowa or someplace that starts with the letter I. Just stay away. I don't care how many advertisements you see for people who struck it rich with penny stocks. Most of the people who strike it rich with penny stocks are the criminals, and they are indeed breaking the law, who are promoting the penny stocks. And there's an old scam called pump and dump that is discussed on the website. You'll see a few examples of penny stocks advertisements and what's happened to people who have invested in them. And then there's that one article of two teenagers who started a scam, a robot that picked stocks. Right, it was just them. And in the face-to-face class, we would take a look at some examples. Now, you go to the website and look at them, and they're everywhere, folks. They're like they're like bad pennies that keep turning up. Slide number 80, foreign stocks, international stocks. Well, traditionally, it was difficult for investors to transact, buy and sell, these foreign stocks that were on other exchanges. And the way that most people would buy foreign companies were through, and still is, American Depository Receipts, ADRs. Sometimes you'll see GDRs, Global Depository Receipts. And what's going on here? Well, what happens is if there's a company that's sufficiently large outside the United States, is a bank or a trust company, one of the Wall Street firms, will go over to Japan, for example, Toyota, Sony, Honda, and they will buy a ton of shares, bring them to New York, and then reissue them in dollars. And those are called American Depository Receipts. But you know what? It's not as important anymore, because most all brokerage firms now have global, international, some depends on who you talk to, what they'll call them, accounts, meaning that you can keep in your account dollars, which is what most people do, but you can also change those dollars to pesos or yen or euros and buy stocks directly in those currencies on the foreign exchanges. Yeah, most all brokerage firms have these accounts now. The problem is the currency. You need to understand how currencies work. It's counterintuitive. For example, if you have an investment in a foreign currency, let's say pesos down in Mexico, and the dollar gets stronger, all other things being equal, and of course they never are, your investment in Mexico is going to go down. It's like a seesaw. The dollar goes up, your investment automatically goes down. Now remember, there's all other things going on, so we have to just look at this as if it were in a laboratory. If the dollar is weaker, automatically your investment goes up. And those of you who travel down to Mexico or outside the country will understand this perfectly. When there's a strong dollar and you go to Europe or some other place around the world, your dollar buys more of those items. So if your dollar gets stronger, any item that you owned outside the country that you owned before the dollar got stronger becomes worth less. And the opposite side of the coin is if the dollar is weaker, now it costs more dollars to buy that item, so that item becomes worth more to you. Most all of us will buy our global, our international, our foreign stocks via mutual funds. That's, you know, the easy way to do it. And remember the distinction. Global means everybody, including the United States. International means everyone except for the United States. Okay, great. So now these types of stocks are going to be the categories that you use when you do your Chapter 5 assignment. The one Chapter 5 assignment where you go do research, the stock market and the stocks. You will not see, maybe you'll see, these categories when you're researching the stock, but you're going to decide what kind of stock is this company. And remember that sometimes companies don't fit into categories very well, or they might fit into one or two categories. Yeah, so don't, do your best. Don't worry about making a mistake. It's not the end of the world. Slide 81. Let's now turn our attention to market capitalization, which is a fancy term for how big is the company. That's really what capitalization means. And there is a very simple calculation. You take the current price of the stock and you multiply it times the number of shares outstanding. There's a worksheet number 3, that will you'll practice doing this, and it may be on an exam. It's not a hard thing to do, folks, so learn how to do it. There are three big categories: the papa bears, the mama bears, and the baby bears. How's that? Can you remember that? You like fairy tales? The large cap stocks are generally considered anything $10 billion and up. Those are the big companies. But there's a subcategory, and I don't care if you remember this. You really should, because you're going to hear people use the term mega cap. But these are companies that have reached the $100 billion stage. They're not that many of them, but they're out there. And these are the General Electrics and the Walmarts and the Exxon Mobils of the world. Right. But just and know that anything $10 billion and up, large cap, $100 billion or up, mega cap. The mid-cap stocks are the mama bears, and many of them you've heard of, but not all of them. And anywhere from about $1 or $2 billion, some people use one, some people use $2 billion as the demarcation line, up to about $10 billion is a mid-cap stock. Of course, if something is $1 or $2 billion, you could choose either. You could choose mid-cap, or you could choose the baby bears, small cap. Because small cap stocks are anywhere from about $100 million to $1 billion or $2 billion, depending on who you talk to, right? And then in the small cap arena is a subcategory called micro cap. But again, I don't care, you should really learn that, because you're going to hear people talk about it. You're going to see mutual funds that are called micro cap mutual funds. And these are generally below $100 million, $10 to $50 million, $75 million, and the like, micro cap. Now, once you get into the penny stock world, these are companies that have very small market capitalization, sometimes in the millions, sometimes in the hundreds of thousands. And these really shouldn't even be discussed in polite company, folks. But they're out there, and I'm going to tell you again, stay away from them, because most all of them are scams. Not all, but yeah. Okay, slide number 82. Here's an example. We have a price of $20. Well, what's the company worth? Well, you don't know. You don't know until you know how many shares are outstanding. 5 million shares outstanding? Well, $20 times 5 million is $100 million of market capitalization. This is what the company is worth. Remember, the price is changing all the time, but this is the moment in time. This is the company, this is the company's value. The stock price, for the most part, dear students, is irrelevant until you get down to the penny world. You must look at the market capitalization to see what the value of the company is. Remember Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, right? He never split the stock, didn't increase the number of shares. You gotta look at what the market cap is. Exactly. Slide 83. Now here are a couple of companies you may have heard of. Walmart and Target, that fabulously exclusive French department store, Target. Oosh. As of January 31st, if you looked at the price of Walmart and Target, you'd say, well, Walmart's 70, almost 75 bucks, Target's 56 and a half. Target's a little bit smaller than Walmart. You intuitively know that Walmart's a whole lot bigger than Target, and you're right. Look at the number of shares outstanding. There are 3.24 billion shares of Walmart, and only 632 million shares of Target. So it turns out that Walmart is seven times larger than Target in terms of market capitalization. They're both large cap stocks. In fact, Walmart is often referred to as a mega cap stock. But Walmart is global. It's all over the world. Target is mostly in the United States. Right. So that's market capitalization. So what does that mean? If you wanted to buy Walmart, you'd have to have $241 billion. Well, really, you'd need more. Why? Because as soon as you started to buy every share that was being offered at any price that was being offered, what would happen to the price? It would start climbing. And so when one company or an individual or a group of investors want to take over a company, what they will do is they will go to the exchange that the company is traded on, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, and they'll say, look, we're looking to buy Target, and we've got $40, $50 billion to do it. We'll offer $42 billion. They will offer a premium, and it's called a tender offer. And there's a methodology for how this information is brought to the public. Because can you imagine? Exactly. Insider information. If you knew that one company was about ready to take over another company, you could jump ahead of the trade. Because what's going to happen is, it's called front running, by the way. What's going to happen is they're going to have a set methodology for announcing a tender offer. We have a tender offer on target for $65 a share, about 10 to 20% premium. And if investors believe that it's a bona fide offer, immediately the price will jump to 65 or maybe a little bit less. If they don't think it's a very good offer, they might not, it might not move the stock at all. They might think, oh, these guys are just blowing smoke. They're not going to be able to pull this off. If, on the other hand, there's a belief that there may be a bidding war, that somebody else might say, uh-oh, we don't want them to buy that company, we'll buy it, then the price might go higher. It happens. But you understand the potential for hanky-panky? Right. Some companies will do this as a way to just feel out what's going on, and in the meantime, they may have made somehow surreptitious, illegal, by the way, trades, and that's the job of the Securities Exchange Commission to root those kind of things out. There are some people who do it as a way to just rattle the markets, and they're big enough that they can. You might have heard of a gentleman by the name of Carl Icahn. And why does he do it? Because Icahn, he will buy a ton of his stock, and then he'll start making noises about it should be higher, or I'm going to buy more, and it's not really illegal what he's doing, but he sure does push his weight around, and he's able to move markets that way and get away with it, and then dump it, and then go on to the next target. No pun intended. Slide number 84. There's a couple other companies you may have heard of, AT&T and Verizon. And you look at the prices and you say, well, Verizon is bigger than AT&T. Wrong. You got to look at the number of shares outstanding. There's 5.32 billion shares of AT&T as of January 31st, whereas there are only 2.86 billion shares of Verizon. So it turns out that AT&T is larger. A significant chunk of change larger than Verizon. They're both large cap. In fact, they're both mega cap companies. The duopoly, as it's called. There's Sprint and T-Mobile, and there's a few other small players. But these are the two 800-pound gorillas. And so, you now understand market capitalization? Right. You can't just look at the price of the stock. You need to look at what the company is worth on a market basis, market capitalization. Okay, let's start on investment strategies. Slide 85. The strategy that you'll find most investors use, in my humble opinion, is buy and hold. It is the strategy that uses fundamental analysis, and what's that? Well, we'll discuss it in detail in Chapter 6, to identify high-quality companies with good growth prospects and potentials for dividends at reasonable prices. We want to buy them at reasonable prices. It goes by various names. Sometimes people use the term value investing, but again, be careful with value versus growth. Growth at a reasonable price, GARP, which I GARP, and the guy wrote the book, The World According to GARP, and they turned it into a movie. Some people will say, well, how long do you hold these stocks? How long do you hold the stock? And they asked Warren Buffett that once. How long, Mr. Buffett, you're a buy and hold investor. Oh, yes, I am. How long should you hold it? He says, hold it forever. Well, he's being a bit facetious there because you don't live forever, of course. But But no, if you had a business that was in the family and you were very proud of it and it was profitable, you'd hold it forever, right? And you'd enjoy the fruits and, as Mr. Bogle says, fruits and potentials, the advantages that businesses have given their owners for time immemorial. So this is my personal favorite. And there's an example on the website that we would show in the face-to-face class, but you take a look at it, called Don't Lose Perspective. Because if you look in the short term, folks, you try to follow the short term gyrations, that can drive you insane, right? But if you look over the long term, providing the world doesn't fall apart and there's a meteorite or a volcano that destroys half of the earth or the Ebola becomes all the rage, whatever, we should do well. From time to time, you will see, if you look through the financial media, reports of the death of buy and hold. You see them all the time, but when you see many of them, and sometimes people say value investing. Is value investing dead? I'll never forget that. This magazine, I forget what it was called, Mutual Fund Investor, something like this, in 2000, had on the cover the Grim Reaper. And it said, is value investing dead? And I thought, no, this is probably the best time to get into it. And it turned out to be the best time to get into buy and hold strategy for value stocks, so to speak. And they were saying growth stocks were the place to be, and value stocks were place not to be. And it turned out they were absolutely wrong. So this is my personal strategy, my favorite. Now, does that mean it should be yours? No, just because I like it and people like Warren Buffett like it doesn't mean you necessarily should. Okay? All right. Slide 86. Income strategy. A very good strategy that works well with buy and hold. Also called equity income. Remember the equity income mutual funds? Stock dividends. Equity means stock. Income means dividends. These are investors that emphasize dividends over capital appreciation. Ideally, you're looking for companies that are growing their dividends, because as we've noted beforehand, companies that pay consistently growing dividends tend to do well when the market as a whole does poorly. In general, the income strategy is great, appropriate for conservative stock investors. Remember, not having to do with politics, having to do with people who don't enjoy losing money. This strategy works well with DRIPs, the dividend reinvestment plans. Many of these companies will let you put in $50 a month if you want, or put in a lump sum, it's up to you, and they will automatically reinvest the dividends in more shares, and in this way it kind of looks like a mutual fund. Stocks which have had histories of consistent dividend increases have often been the market's best long-term investments. Yes. Now, the growth strategy, slide 87. Remember the growth stars, they're the ones, the growth stocks are the stars. You invest in stocks with above average forecasts of earnings growth, not worried about dividends, often have a high price to earnings ratio in expectation of higher earnings in the future. Remember, people often use the term growth. They mean a high PE stock. Everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon as a company is experiencing strong growth. Subsequently, the stock is bid up to very high levels. Typically, these are also the stocks that are the riskiest, because when the slightest hint of a slowdown in the growth appears, the stock price is often brutally punished. So sure, the company may still be growing, but that growth is slowing down. You calculus fans, that's the second derivative, exactly. And that is enough to just have people run for the exits. So you have to be ready to either do that likewise or just sit tight and say, look, I'm in it for the long term. Slide 88, aggressive growth strategy. Oh boy, sometimes called speculation, short-term trading, buy and sell. Investors aggressively trade in and out of stocks in order to achieve eye-catching returns. instead of waiting 3 to 5 years for a stock, and why is 3 to 5 years so often discussed, we'll discuss that later in Chapter 6. An aggressive stock trader would go after the same investment return in 6 months to a year, or less. Some traders have time horizons in the weeks or days, and there are companies who are using computers to make millions of trades per day. Right. Now, what I've noticed is that this is the strategy that many people think they're supposed to use when they start investing in stocks. They've inherited $10,000 or $15,000, and they surround themselves with computers and these programs that tell them when to buy and sell. And, good luck. Good luck. It is fraught with perils and drawbacks, not the least of which are the serious transaction costs that can be generated as a result of frequent trading. Stockbrokers simply adore suckers. Speculators who use this strategy. So are you going to be a speculator, an aggressive growth strategy? If you do, just remember, keep your eyes wide open. Remember that it is more likely that you're going to lose than win. But I wish you the best of success, and if you do, and how about this? Take 10% of your portfolio, maybe 20%. And if you are so inclined, do some aggressive growth trading with it. All right? How's that? The rest you put into very stable, long... Okay, all right, maybe that's a great idea for you. Now, slide number 89, contrarian strategy. I'm a big fan of contrarian, but I don't do it with regard to stocks. It's not easy. Contrarians invest in stocks that are out of favor with the market for some reason, as reflected by low price-to-earnings ratios, low prices compared to their fundamentals. We'll discuss fundamentals in Chapter 6 in detail. Contrarian investors actively seek stocks from companies with sound financial statements that the market, for some reason or another, has undervalued. And here are some quotes from some great contrarians. I always try to be accommodating. I buy when others want to sell, and I sell when others want to buy. But the problem is, it's difficult. Being a contrarian is difficult, since historically the market rises about 3 times as much as it falls. As we said, it goes up 3 or 4 years for every 1 year it goes down. So if you're always selling your stocks when the market's going up very quickly, you won't have any stocks. So how do you address that? One very famous contrarian, Howard Marks of Oak Tree Capital, said, look, it's not a steady business. You have to be willing to sit on your hands when things are normally crazy. When they become abnormally crazy, that's when you rush in. And for a tremendous example of contrarian investing, we look to no other than Warren Buffett. Throughout the 2000s, he didn't do much in terms of investing with his company, Berkshire Hathaway, which buys other companies they own, or they did. I think they sold the Washington Post. They own Geico. They own the Burlington Northern Railroad. They own a big chunk of Dairy Queen, a big chunk of McDonald's and Coca-Cola and Procter & Gamble. And he just basically sat back. In 2008, when the wheels fell off, when the organic matter hit the ventilating device and the stock market was plummeting, he rushed in, bought $5 billion of GE, because GE needed some capital, money, and he bought $5 billion of Goldman Sachs, because Goldman Sachs needed cash, and he bought these special shares that you and I would not buy. And it turned out to be a genius move. He made a ton of money off of these things. And he put an opinion piece, in the Wall Street Journal saying, look, I'm buying America now. I know everybody's worried about the entire system falling apart, but I'm jumping in. And then about a year and a half later, he bought a ton of Bank of America. And all three have turned out to be great investments. The Goldman Sachs was the best. I mean, he raked it in, folks, and... Now, we're going to talk about, later on, preferred stock. And basically, these are stocks that corporations buy when one corporation wants to buy another corporation or own a big chunk of it. He was getting 10% a year on his $5 billion. That's $500 million a year on his $5 billion. And he had an option for Goldman Sachs to buy back the shares, you know, pay him the $5 billion back. But when they did, they had to pay an additional $500 million just to buy back their shares so that they didn't have to pay 10% every year in perpetuity. Yeah, what a deal. Of course, if Goldman Sachs had gone out of business, he would have been left holding the bag, but you know, Goldman Sachs is not going to go out of business, folks. They are needed in this world as much as they are hated by many. So, you want to be a contrarian? It ain't easy. You have to be willing to sit on your hands. And I must say, that with regard to stocks, I'm not much of a contrarian. I'm more of a buy and hold. I just buy every month through my 403B, through my Roth IRA, and sometimes, you know, other times when things look not so good, things are down, I'll buy more just to juice things. But with regard to real estate, I was a contrarian investor. For years, my wife would say, why are we always buying stocks? Why don't we buy some real estate? And I'd say, because it's too darn expensive in San Diego. And then in 2008, 9, 10, the prices just plummeted on real estate. So I said to her, why don't we take a look? And it turned out it was a great time to buy real estate. There's still a lot of good deals out there, but not like there were in 2009, 10, 11, and 12. 2013, real estate started to rebound smartly, and interest rates are still pretty low. Real estate seems to be still a pretty good deal, but I can say that I was a contrarian real estate investor. And we'll discuss real estate way at the end, just a little. This is not a real estate course. This is a securities financial investment course. Slide number 90. A few other strategies that I hope you stay away from. I call these dumb, dumber, and dumbest. Sector rotation. You'll hear people say, what are the hot sectors these days, right? They're in the places you want to be in. Well, until they become stale, right? And the one that you thought was hot, you stick with until finally you give up and you go over to the hot one just in time for that one to go bad, and the one that you were in to go hot. And so if you think you can do it, you go right ahead. And people will use sector funds, remember chapter 4 of the sector funds, to rotate between sectors. All right, do 5-10% of your 401k, all right? Momentum investing, buy stocks as they go up, sell stocks as they go down. This is another term for the aggressive in growth investor. It often involves selling stocks short when stocks are going down, and we said that's how you make money when stocks go down, and we'll discuss selling short in detail much later on. This is the greater fool theory. What? Yeah, right. Somebody out there is a greater fool than I, than I am. And does this sound familiar? Right. This is what happened in the world of real estate throughout the 2000s, where housing prices just skyrocketed, and people said, well, don't worry, somebody else, some other fool will, right, and buy high, sell higher. You can see the problem with this, right? When the music is playing, it's wonderful, and everybody's making tons of cash. Run down quick, they're giving away free money. And then when the music stops, market timing. Attempting to predict the future direction of the market. Don't do it, is my advice. But again, I'll quote from Mr. Bernard Baruch, a very famous investor from the mid-20th century. Don't try to buy at the bottom and sell at the top. It can't be done except by liars. And as we said, I think a lot of these people, they lie to themselves, really. They basically, they'll convince themselves that their system is going to work. Hasn't worked yet, but so can you see the risks inherent in each of these strategies? Right. And so now, dear students, Let's ask you, what strategy would you favor on slide 91? Well, I know. This is why I try to do my best to impart information without imparting my personal opinion. But when there's an obvious situation where I am biased, I'll tell you beforehand. I'll say, look, you know, I'm biased toward this strategy. So don't think you have to pick buy and hold just because I like it. Pick it because Warren Buffett likes it. Okay. And there we are, folks. We are done with our first chapter, just our introduction to stocks. Now, you got to learn all this information. And I know it's a lot. It's much to learn. That's why you're going to study every day, right? Nod your heads yes. Thank you very much. But wait until you see our next chapter, folks. You are going to be introduced to techniques that most people have no idea even exist. Are they going to make you a better investor? Are they going to make you the next Warren Buffett? I can't guarantee that. Are they going to make investing fail-safe and guaranteed? No. But what we will see, in my humble opinion, is that they will tilt the odds in your favor. It's not a guarantee. But you will learn techniques that should help you in the long term be a better investor. Or at least stay away from companies that will crash and burn. Right? How's that? Okay, see you in Chapter 6 when we discuss in detail valuation, common stock valuation. How do we put a price tag on a stock?